Zugo watched Jordan ride back down the pass towards the wind-darkened waters of Table Bay and the sprawling white buildings that clung to the lower slopes of the mountain under the dingy scudding sky. Then he turned his own mount into the wind and went down the other side. The excitement stayed with him. He realized that it was Rhodes's particular genius to awaken this feeling in men around him. Even though there were quicksands ahead, in which he knew he might soon be engulfed, the enthusiasm and quickness of spirit persisted. 10 land grants meant 40,000 acres of land. But it would take more than £10,000 to hold it. Homestead and wells and fences to build, cattle to stock it, men to work it. All that would cost money. A great deal of money. The gold claims. He could not even begin to imagine how much it might cost to transport stamp mills and sluice boxes from the railhead. Of course, for lack of money to exploit them, he would have to pass by 100 opportunities that the new land would offer. In the beginning, the land grants of other men would be for sale at bargain prices, hundreds of thousands of acres of the land that he had always thought of as his own. And because he did not have the money, it would go to others. None of this could break the mood. Not the cold rain in his face that numbed his cheeks. Not the realization that his dream was still merely a dream. For now, at last, they were on the move, at the breakneck pace set by an impatient man, towards the realization of that dream. So Zuga could lift his chin and sit up straight in the saddle, ignoring the icy snakes of rainwater that wriggled down inside his collar, buoyed high above mundane doubts by the gambler's certainty that at last his luck had changed. The dice were hot for him, and every time he rolled, the aces would flash like spearheads. The sheets of rain hid the cottage from Zuga until he turned in under the milkwood grove. Then a fluke of the wind opened the slanting silver sheets of water, and his mood popped like a bubble. He had been mistaken. His luck had not changed. It had all been words and illusion. The caravan of his misfortunes rolled on unchecked. For before him, his home was partially destroyed. One of the ancient milkwoods, weary of resisting the gales of 100 winters, had succumbed at last. It had come crashing down across the front of the cottage. The roof had given under the blow and sagged in. The supports of the veranda had shattered, and a tangle of fallen roof beams and milkwood branches blocked the front entrance. The living room would be swamped with rain, his books, his papers. Appalled at the havoc, he dismounted and stood before it, and his spirits slid further. He felt his ribs constricting, his breathing, and dread uncoiled in his guts like an awakening serpent. It was the superstitious terror of one who has offended the gods. The pillar of blue marbled rock that he had set to guard his threshold had been thrown down. It lay half under the tumbled thatch with the shattered veranda support beside it. Once it had been hard and smooth as granite, but the sunlight and the air had rotted it, and the fall had shattered it like chalk. Zugo went down on one knee and touched a rough, irregular lump of the smashed blue ground. The destruction of his home was as nothing. This was the only one of his possessions that was irreplaceable, and the omen of its destruction struck frost into the secret places of his soul. Almost as a chorus to his dread, a fresh rain squall came booming down the valley, thrashing the trees and ripping at the scattered thatch. Rain beat down onto the broken surface of the rock he was touching. And at Zuga's fingertips there was a tiny burst of white lightning, so dazzling, so searing, that it seemed it could flay the skin from his finger as he touched it. But it was cold, cold as a crystal of Arctic ice. It had never been exposed to the light of day, not once in the 200 million years since it had assumed its present form, and yet it seemed in itself to be a drop of distilled sunlight. Zuga had never seen anything so beautiful, nor touched anything so sensual, for it was the beacon and the lodestone of his life. It made all the striving and the heartbreak seem worthwhile. It was justification for the years he had believed squandered. It exonerated his once firmly held belief that his road to the north began in the gaping chasm of De Beer's new rush. With hands that shook, like those of a very old man, he fumbled open the blade of his clasp knife and gently prized that rainbow of light from its niche in the shattered blue rock, and held it up before his own eyes. "The Ballantine Diamond," he whispered, and staring into its limpid liquid depths, like a sorcerer into his divining ball of crystal, he saw light and shadow ripple and change, and in his imagination become vistas of enchanted pastures rich with sweet grass. He saw slow herds of cattle, and the headgear of winding wheels of fabulous gold mines spinning against a high blue sky. They didn't expect him. He came so swiftly that no runner brought word ahead of him. He had left Rudd and the rest of the party to follow from the Shashi, and ridden on ahead, leading two spare horses, and changing as soon as the mount beneath him tired. The horses were the pick of De Beer's stables, and it took him 5 days from the frontier of Matabeleland to Kami Mission. "I'm Jordan Ballantyne," he said, and looked down on the family that had hastily assembled on the front veranda of the mission. The siege was over without a shot fired. He walked in with his curls shining and that warm, almost shy smile on his lips, and took their hearts, every one of them, by storm. The gifts he brought had been chosen with obvious care, and spoke of a knowledge of each of them and their individual needs. There were 2 dozen packets of seeds for Clinton, unusual vegetables and rare herbs, comfrey and okra, horseradish and turmeric, shallot and susu. For Robin, a box of medicines, which included a bottle of chloroform and a folding wallet of shiny, sharp surgical instruments. The latest volume of Tennyson's poetry for Selina, a pair of marvellous lifelike china dogs with moving eyes for the twins, and for Kathy, the best of all, a box of oil paints, a bundle of brushes, and a letter from Ralph. In the first week, while he waited for Rudd and the rest of the party to come up from the Shashi, Jordan used a green twig to divine water, an art that Clinton had never acquired, and helped him dig the new well. They hit clear, sweet water 10 feet down. He recited to Kathy a biography of Ralph from the day and hour of his birth, which was so minutely detailed that it took instalments over the entire week to complete, while she listened with a fixed avidity. He rolled up his sleeves, and from the black wood-burning stove produced a flow of culinary phenomena, quenelles and soufflés, croques en bouche and meringues, sauces both hollandaise and béarnaise. And while Selina hovered near him, eager to learn and help, he quoted to her the entire In Memoriam of Alfred Lord Tennyson from memory. "So fret not like an idle girl, that life is dashed with flecks of sin. Abide, thy wealth is gathered in when time hath sundered shell from pearl." And she was utterly enchanted by his golden spell. He showed the twins how to cut and fold from a piece of newspaper all manner of fantastic bird and animal shapes, and he told stories that were the best they had heard since Mungo St. John had left Kami. For Robin, he had the latest news from the Cape. He was able to describe for her the rising stars on the political horizon, and categorize their strengths and weaknesses. He had the latest assessments of the political scene at home. Members of both Houses of Parliament, Cape and Home, were constant guests at Groot-Schuur, so he could repeat the gossip of that wild and incomprehensible old man, as the Queen had called Gladstone. He could explain the Home Rule issue, and tell her what the odds were for a Liberal victory at the next election, even after Gladstone's failure to rescue Gordon from Khartoum, and his consequential loss of popularity. At the Queen's Jubilee, the common people on the pavements cheered him, but the aristocracy hissed him from the balconies, he told her. For Robin, this was nectar to a woman lost over 20 years in the wilderness. Dinners at Kami usually finished by the fall of dark, and the family was abed an hour later. But after Jordan's arrival, the talk and laughter sometimes lasted until midnight. "Jordan, there is no doubt that if we want Mashonaland, we shall have to square your aunt. I hear that Lobengula will not make a major decision about Dr. Codrington. I want you to go on ahead of Rudd and the others. Go to Kami and talk to your aunt." That had been Mr. Rhodes's parting injunction to him, and Jordan's conscience found no conflict between this duty and his family loyalties. Again and again in that week, Jordan returned to extol Mr. Rhodes to Robin, his integrity and sincerity, his vision of a world at peace and united under one sovereign power. Instinctively, he knew which ideas and which areas of Rhodes's character to emphasize to Robin. Patriotism, charity, his sympathetic treatment of his black workers, his opposition to the Stropping Act in the Cape Parliament, which, if passed, would have given employers the right to lash their black servants. And only when he judged that she was swayed to his views did Jordan mention the concession to her. Yet, despite his preparations, her opposition was immediate and ferocious. "Not another tribe robbed of its lands," she cried. "We do not want Matabeleland, Auntie. Mr. Rhodes would guarantee Lobengula's sovereignty and protect him." "I read the letter you wrote to the Cape Times, Auntie, expressing your concern over the Matabele raids into Mashonaland. With the British flag flying over the Shona tribes, they would be protected by British justice. The Germans and Portuguese and Belgians are gathering like vultures. You know, Auntie, that there is only one nation fit to take on the sacred trust." Jordan's arguments were calculated and persuasive, his manner without guile, and his trust in Cecil John Rhodes touching and infectious. And he kept returning to his most poignant argument. "Auntie, you have seen the Matabele bucks returning from Mashonaland, with the blood caked on their blades, and the captured Shona girls roped together. Think of the havoc that they have left behind them. The burned villages, the murdered infants and greyheads, the slaughtered Shona warriors. You cannot deny the Shona people the protection that we will offer." That night she spoke to Clinton, lying beside him in the darkness in the narrow cot, on the hard, straw-filled mattress. And his reply was immediate and simple. "My dear, it has always been clear to me, as the African sun, that God has prepared this continent for the protection of the only nation on earth that has the public virtue sufficient to govern it for the benefit of its native peoples. Clinton, Mr. Rhodes is not the British nation. He is an Englishman. So was Edward Teach, alias Blackbeard the Pirate." They were silent for many minutes, and then Robin said suddenly, "Clinton, have you noticed anything wrong with Selina?" His concern was immediate. "Is she sickening?" "I'm afraid so, incurably. I think she is in love." "Good gracious." He sat abruptly upright in the bed. "Who on earth is she in love with? How many young men are there at Carmi at the present time?" In the morning, on the way to her clinic in the church, she stopped at the kitchen. The previous evening, Clinton had slaughtered a pig, and now Selina and Jordan were making sausages. He was turning the handle of the mincing machine while she forced lumps of pork into the funnel. They were so absorbed, chatting so gaily together, that while Robin stood in the doorway watching them, they were unaware of her presence. They made a beautiful couple. So beautiful, indeed, that Robin felt a sense of unreality as she watched them, and it was followed immediately by uneasiness. Nothing in life was that perfect. Selina saw her and started, and then unaccountably blushed so that her pixie-pointed ears glowed. "Oh, Mama, you startled me!" Robin felt a rush of empathy, and strangely, of envy for her eldest daughter. She wished that she was still capable of that pure and innocent emotion. And suddenly she had the contrasting image of Mungo St. John, lean and scarred and unscrupulous. And what she felt shocked her, so her voice was brusque. "Jordan, I have made up my mind. When Mr. Rudd arrives, I will go with you to Lobengula's kraal, and I will speak for your case." After a prolonged and unprofitable trading expedition as far as the Zambezi, Mungo had returned with Louise to the kraal at Gubulawayo, where they were kept almost 7 months. But Lobengula's procrastinations worked in Mungo St. John's favour. Robin Codrington had refused to speak to the king on Mungo's behalf, and consequently he was only one among dozens of white concession seekers camped around Lobengula's royal kraal. The king would not have let Mungo leave, even if he had wanted to. He seemed to enjoy talking to him, and listened eagerly to Mungo's accounts of the American war and of Mungo's sea voyages. Every week or so he would summon Mungo to an audience and question him through his interpreter for hours at a time. The destructive power of cannon fascinated him, and he demanded detailed descriptions of sundered walls and human bodies blown to nothingness. The sea was another source of intense interest, and he tried to grasp the immensity of waters, and the blast of storm and gale across it. However, when Mungo delicately hinted at a land grant and trading concession, Lobengula smiled and sent him away. "I will call for you again, One Bright Eye, when I have thought on it more heavily. Now, is there aught you lack in food or drink? I will send my women to your camp with it." Once he gave Mungo permission to go out into the hunting veld, so long as he stayed south of the Shangani River and killed neither elephant nor hippopotamus. On this expedition, Mungo shot a huge cock ostrich and salted and dried the skin with its magnificent plumage intact. On three other occasions, the king allowed him to return to Kami Mission Station when Mungo complained that his leg was paining him. Mungo's predatory instinct was that Robin Codrington was disturbed and excited by these returns, and each time he was able to draw out the visit for days, gradually consolidating his position with her, so that when he again asked her to intercede with Lobengula on his behalf, she actually thought about it for a full day before refusing once more. "I cannot set a cat upon a mouse, General St. John." "Madam, I freed my own slaves many years ago." "When you were forced to," she agreed. "But who will control you here in Matabele Land?" "You, Robin, and gladly would I submit to that." She had flushed and turned her face away from him to hide the colour. "Your familiarity is presumptuous, sir." And she had left him so that he could keep his revived assignations under the Leadwood tree with the twins. His absence since those first encounters in his convalescence had not dimmed their fascination for him. They had become invaluable allies. Nobody else could have extracted from Juba the vital information he needed for his planning. Mungo had expressed doubts as to the existence of the diamonds and declared that he would only be convinced if the twins could tell him where Lobengula kept the treasure. Juba never suspected danger from such an innocent pair, and in the late afternoon, when she had drunk a gallon pot of her own famous brew, she was always genial and garrulous.
"Ningi keeps the diamonds under her sleeping place," Vicky informed Mungo.
"Who is Ningi?"
"The king's sister, and she's almost as fat as King Ben is."
Ningi would be the most trusted of all Lobengula's people, and her hut in the sanctuary of the Forbidden Women's Quarters was the most secure in all Matabele Land. "I believe you now. You are clever girls, both of you," Mungo told them, and they glowed with pleasure. There was nothing he could not ask of them.
"Vicky, I need some paint. It's for a secret thing. I will tell you about it later, if you can get the paint for me." "What colour?" Lizzie cut in. "I'll get it for you." "Red, white, and yellow."
In the end, Lizzie stood guard while Vicky raided Kathy's paint box, and they delivered their offering to Mungo and basked in his extravagant praise. In his planning, it was not enough merely to get the diamonds into his hands. Even more vital was to escape the consequences. No man or woman could hope to reach the frontier without the king's permission. It was hundreds of miles of wild country patrolled by the border impis. He could not grab and run. He had to use guile and perhaps turn the Matabele dread of darkness and witchcraft to his own advantage. So he planned with meticulous concentration, and waited for the right moment with the patience of the stalking leopard, for he knew that this was his last attempt. If he failed this time, then not even his white skin nor his status as a guest of the king could save him. If he failed, the black ones would wield their knobkerries, crushing in his skull, and his corpse would be flung from the cliffs to the waiting vultures or into the flooded river pools where the crocodiles would rip it into chunks with their spiky yellow saurian teeth. Louise would suffer the same fate, he knew, but it was a chance he was prepared to take.